You are listening to the Down the Wormhole podcast, exploring the strange and fascinating relationship between science and religion. This week, our hosts are
Ian Benz, associate professor at UNC Charlotte in elementary science education. And I have done karaoke once or twice, and the song I did that I absolutely love doing was, I think it's called Strokin' by Clarence Carter.
Kendra Holton Moore, and I would sing I Want to Dance with Somebody by Whitney Houston, because what else are you going to sing? It's not going to be better than that.
Well, I'm Zach Jackson, UCC pastor in Reading, Pennsylvania, and as somebody who grew up in Jersey, my go-to has to be Living on a Prayer, which always gets the bar going and fits the theme of the episode today.
Rachel Jackson, rabbi at Agudas Israel Congregation in Hendersonville, North Carolina. And were I to do karaoke, which I have not yet done, much to the chagrin of my husband, who loves it and is great at it, I would probably do something totally out of character, such as Gangster's Paradise from Coolio, or It Wasn't Me by Shaggy.
Ooh.
Oh, that's a good song.
Ooh.
You let her catch you? Say it wasn't you.
Also not appropriate for our younger listeners.
No, that's always man. So funny. Y'all are raising the rating of this podcast.
But Living on a Prayer is also a really great one. And we could all get behind that song, especially when we're talking about prayer in particular places today.
Yeah, because, you know, Tommy used to work on the docks, but the union's been on strike and he's down on his luck. So tough.
Now I want to listen to Clarence Carter.
Not John Bon Jovi?
I do that one as well. I just want to listen to all the songs we've talked about.
Bon Jovi peaked early. Anyway, so thank you, Rachel, for trying to segue cleanly. I apologize for derailing it early. Yeah. Right.
So last week we talked a lot about, where prayer is and how we can look at it, and we delved into we didn't really talk about prayer last week. We talked about various religious freedoms and how they are exampled in individual businesses, right? Non-governmental organizations, and what that actually means for people when they take their issues to the government, to the courts, and say, my religious protection, and how does that infringe on a person's rights in a capitalistic society? And this week, we wanted to say, okay, well, if we're not looking at businesses and we're not dealing just with capitalism, but we're really looking at the government itself and where prayer is there, right? We can go back a couple of episodes and look at when the local pastor had to be there to moderate and calm everybody down in the 18th century and say, no, 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 don't fight, don't kill each other, and how that has honestly evolved or devolved to what we have today. So I sort of want to open that up and say, what do we feel? How do we, the four of us here, feel about having a prayer before the opening of any governmental meeting, whether it is the city council or all the way up through, Supreme Court hearings or the opening of Congress and wherever else they do prayers. Mm. So how do you?
So I have the records, the transcripts from James Madison from that constitutional convention, which was nearing the end. And things were getting really heated over specifically the issue of federal power versus state power and representation of the smaller states in the houses of Congress. And there's a lot of fighting because we don't get along as a nation. And Franklin just stood up and he gave a long speech, but here is just a snippet of it. He said, "In this situation of this assembly, groping as it were in the dark to find political truth, and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understanding?" And then further down, "I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an entire empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, by the sacred writings, that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain to build it. I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. We shall be divided by our little partial local interests. Our projects will be confounded, and we ourselves shall become a reproach and a byword down to future ages. And what is worse, mankind may hereafter, from this unfortunate instance, despair of establishing governments, be human wisdom, and leave it to chance, war, and conquest. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayer imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessing on our deliberations be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business, and that one or more of the clergy of the city be requested to officiate in that service." And just to be clarified, this is not just Pastor Johnson down the street coming in to offer a 30-second opening prayer. What they're referring to is a full-on service at the beginning of every session of Congress. That, like, they want a sermon and a long prayer and the liturgies and the smells and bells of all of the religious service. They're, what some historians think, is trying to change the tone of the meeting itself, because people feel less free to argue as harshly in church in those days as they would in a government building. And so to change the mood of the place, because he's a confounding person. He is at once kind of a secular humanist, but he's also deeply devout. And he's a Quaker, but he's also not a pacifist. So he defies a lot of our classifications. And it seems very much so that he wants to have a whole religious service at the beginning. And there was a lot of back and forth about this. It seemed one of the things that people said was, if we do this now, people are going to notice, and they're going to wonder why we didn't do it from the beginning. And then they're going to assume that it's because now we're having problems, and they're going to know we're having problems, and then they're not going to have faith in this institution. So we can't do this because we don't want to lose faith. And then somebody else was like, hey, here's another thing. We don't have money. We can't pay this guy to come out and do this, because obviously you're going to pay this person and they can't afford to. Kind of non-canonically, Alexander Hamilton stands up and is vehemently opposed to this whole practice. And he says that we should not be asking for foreign aid in the midst of this, which was a funny little quip from a sarcastic little 20-something-year-old. But in the end, what they came to was, okay, we're not going to have a prayer service at the beginning of every government meeting, but we will ask that on the 4th of July, on the anniversary of our independence, that we would ask the local clergy in Philadelphia to hold a special service in honor of the nation. And so they did, and they had this big service before they went back to meeting. And then after that, they hired two chaplains from different denominations, though both Protestant Christian denominations. So a little bit diverse, but not totally, to give opening prayers. And then from that point on until the present day, there are two chaplains who are paid a stipend and who open in prayer. And that's the origin of this. It was partially due to the religious belief that we need to have God in our deliberations, or else we're going to be like the people in the Tower of Babel, which, for those of you who are not familiar with your Pentateuch, that is the story at the beginning of humanity when everybody spoke the same language and they were super productive because everyone was on the same page, and they got proud of that and they started building a great tower to heaven. They were going to approach God, God's self, and then God confounded their languages so that they wouldn't be able to communicate and they wouldn't be able to work together, and they would scatter across the earth because they didn't follow the original command to scatter.
I would have to add to that story, though, that the reason for the scattering was not just not following that. That's what the deity wanted at that time. But because of the hubris of the people who were saying, look how great we are, and we can overtake this deity, and we can become like this deity. It became such a source of arrogance that part of the solution was then also the scattering, right? That it wasn't just, you know, yay, cooperation, and cooperation gets us really far, which we kind of agree with at this point. But it was the arrogance of, look how great humans are, and look how amazing we are. We can defeat anything and anyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of the founders pick up on that in the early days, and they say we're just being another Babel, assuming that we as humans can pull this off without divine help.
Right.
Which is a contentious point in the early days of the country. So it is a little disingenuous to say that all of the founders were in agreement that religion had no place in government, because most of them did think it did to some extent, at least insofar as it didn't interfere with their own practice of religion. They were not as diverse as we are today, so this argument was not as... This argument was between like Presbyterians and Lutherans. It wasn't between Muslims and Christians and Buddhists and Jews and people of very diverse faith, not just diverse interpretations of the same faith.
So one thing I'm curious about when it comes to things like prayer, starting off, you know, government meetings, schools, that kind of stuff, is do any of you know why is it acceptable that in the chambers of Congress they can pray? Like people, they can invite ministers, priests, clergy, you know, rabbi, whatever. They can invite people to come and lead a prayer to start off things. So why is that okay there, but not okay elsewhere?
So that is actually part of my question and my discomfort. So I am a rabbi in a small town, which is very ecumenically diverse, meaning we have lots of different kinds of Christians, but not diverse outside of Christianity. So there's, you know, there are a few Muslims and a few Jews, and there might be somebody other than the Abrahamic faiths, but if so, they're not really out loud in this area. And so to showcase diversity, I'm often asked to go to said prayer meetings, or, you know, to offer the invocation. And so I've been offered to do that, and I accept. I always accept if it fits my schedule. So, but it makes me uncomfortable, because if we're saying there's a separation of church and state, then why are we having any kind of church, whatever that concept is, why are we having any religion at a clearly state function, right? That is my problem. But to answer your dilemma, Ian, I don't know why it's not at the other ones. Why it's not at school makes a lot of sense, because we require people to go to school, right? You're not required to attend a city council meeting. You're not. So that's one. Secondly, the tax dollars are paying for it, but I think that still works in both cases. But third, and I think this is more important, they're minors. They're people that have no personal autonomy, as opposed to an adult who could leave or who could stand up for themselves more, you know, and they are separated from their guardians. So to me, the school issue is very separate from a government building.
I wonder if it's also maybe that governmental spaces, when they invite someone to pray, the person that they are inviting to pray is not a governmental employee, whereas mm-hmm. at a public school, having like teachers or the staff lead prayers over the intercom in the morning or whatever mm-hmm. it is they do or don't do is a more obvious infringement, maybe, which like I don't totally buy that argument, but I think that could be an explanation for why you would see that difference.
Yeah, and that's what the courts found in that North Carolina case in Rowan County, where they were opening in prayer every meeting for years. But it was always the council members who opened in prayer. It wasn't a third party. And so that's what made the difference between this one and other governmental meetings that have opened in prayer. It was that it was done by the leaders, which meant that it gave a kind of tacit approval to that particular religion in a way that it wouldn't have if they were just inviting local pastors to come pray.
Right, but there is the chaplain for like the House of Representatives is typically, I believe, is the one who does the prayer. They sometimes will they'll host people, but the chaplain, who is a government employee paid for by our tax dollars, does start with a prayer. And I thought I saw somewhere recently or just a little bit ago about that this did go up to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court sided with allowing prayer because of historic precedence, from what I understand.
Yeah, it's not the first time there was controversy. I mean, way back in the 1800s, there were controversies because prayer is controversial sometimes. And I do this. Yeah. I do this on Sundays. I say a prayer after I preach a sermon, and I always end up in some way, shape, or form restating the main point of my sermon in the prayer just because it's fresh in my mind. And so when a chaplain is opening up a service, there's this one chaplain in the 1850s or so who kept praying against against gambling in stocks and in bonds on Wall Street, and because he saw it as this grave sin, and so much so that the representative from Chicago asked that he be removed because he was getting too personal and political. At one point, they tried to get rid of the chaplain position, and they wanted to just make it a volunteer position so that they wouldn't be infringing on people's religious rights, but they couldn't find anyone who wanted to volunteer to be the chaplain of the government. And so they had to go back to paying people.
Okay.
Yeah. And so far, with the exception of one or two Unitarians and Universalists, we've had nothing but Christians
serving as that chaplain.
Serving as the chaplain, yeah. Which...
Yeah. Bay chaplain.
And they are, if we were to today, if we didn't have a chaplain of Congress, if we were today to say, hey, we should have this, it would never pass. You would never be able to start this institution today, but it continues going because it's been there before. And if I can take a moment, because Adam's not here, to quote Thomas Paine.
T-Pain.
A long history of not considering a thing wrong gives it the superficial appearance of being right. And at first, there will be a formidable cry in the name of tradition, but soon tumult subsides. Time makes more converts than reason. I think I got that right. That's the preface. That's the preface to Common Sense. But that concept, I think, is important when we're talking about government. A long history of not considering a thing wrong gives it the superficial appearance of being right.
I wonder, what if we just slowly chipped away at the historical precedence of having prayer? What if we slowly chipped away at it by just watering it down a bit? Instead of having chaplains come pray from specific traditions, what if we just like gave a moment of silence? Which, you know, doesn't make everybody happy, but you're not going to make everybody happy. And then eventually, people maybe wouldn't feel so attached to the role of chaplain. I don't know.
I think that sounds like a very lovely idea.
Because that's right, basically what some like interfaith spaces sometimes basically do just that. And it's not that it's like more meaningful for people, but I don't know. I feel conflicted about it.
Mm-hmm. Right. A moment of a silent reflection, right? How do you want to frame yourself today? Mm. I think the pushback is, I mean, you guys said the word tradition. And so, of course, I go to the story of Tevye, of Fiddler on the Roof, who is just throughout the entire movie is just screaming about tradition, right? He's
that's a good karaoke song.
It does make a good song. But you have to get your arms out and actually shake it too, right? Tradition. Right, you got to do the whole thing.
Well, Alan.
I love that.
Yeah. But what's interesting, especially if we don't look at the movie version and we really go back to the stories, which were written at the turn of the 20th century, give or take, over a very long period of time, and as a social and political commentary, the character of Tevye is actually rather, I'm using this in a clinical sense, pathetic, right? He's really just so clinging to this idea, and he doesn't know how to let go, and he doesn't know why, and he doesn't actually firmly believe these things, because he sees in his daughters that change is coming and change is okay, but he doesn't know how to say in and of himself it is okay. And so Kendra, when I hear you say, well, what about, you know, a moment of silence or a moment of silent reflection, whatever language we would couch that in, I still don't know if that would sit well with people. And I wonder if it just takes, you know, to use the cliche, just rip the Band-Aid off. Just say, no, we're done, right? And people who are going to cling to it are going to cling to it no matter what. And others will just say, okay, we still love you. That's nice. But we still got to live our life in our way, right? And add yet another piece of disagreement to our society.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. I think my saying the thing about like using a watered down version, you know, moment of silence, is more a pessimism about like the people who could rip the Band-Aid off will be outnumbered by the people who want the tradition. And so I just think like I appreciate and respect and often feel like I embody the, you know, like revolutionary desire, the revolutionary spirit to like have change now. Mm-hmm. But the like more pessimistic side of me believes that you just have to have slow change sometimes. Mm-hmm. Not always.
So
what I think, but
so that's been a fine line that schools have tried to walk, because it does seem like a really good middle ground. You give the students who want to pray a chance to pray. You give the students who don't a chance not to. But this has gone to the courts a couple of times. Wallace versus Jaffrey in 85 and a number of others that said that there's still an unspoken assumption that you are going to take that time to pray. Mm-hmm. And if they say, take this time to pray or to meditate, it's still the assumption that there's going to pray. There was a kid in West Virginia, a Jewish kid, who decided during that time to read a novel instead of having a moment. It's a moment of silence, technically, mm-hmm. but instead of praying or meditating, he read a novel and then was bullied and picked on by all of the people around him. And they said that, you know, you're going to hell with all the rest of you people. And it provided a space for somebody to be othered and segregated. And that was a part of this case, a Walter versus West Virginia Board of Education. That plus the Jehovah's Witnesses who believe that you're not supposed to salute a flag or to recite a pledge of allegiance, that your allegiance right. belongs to God only. And so this was all wrapped up together, that you can't coerce a person into doing something that is against their religious beliefs. And the whole moment of silence thing, I get it. I do. But if there's the underlying assumption that the majority of people are going to be praying to a specific God, then it gets a little wibbly wobbly. And it's different in schools. And the courts have made this very clear. It's different in schools because children are more impressionable and they take things, they're more susceptible to peer pressure and to assuming that those in authority are telling them the truth. They're just more malleable. And so you have to be more careful not to indoctrinate them early. Whereas you can have a moment of silence at a football game and it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
This is coming from somebody who's a professional prayer, by the way. So let nobody at home think that I'm against prayer as a practice.
And I have to agree with Zach. It's also part of my job description and general demeanor. I'm still uncomfortable with it too, right? Given, I just don't know about that compromise.
Yeah, I don't like it when it's forced upon people in a place that is a government space or anything like that. It just, but even elsewhere too, unless I'm in my place of worship or in that kind of environment, I don't mind if I want to stop and do a prayer myself. I don't mind if anyone else wants to stop and do a prayer. What would bother me is that if everyone said, okay, all of you now need to stand and read off this prayer I just handed to you. That would bother me. Like, well, I may stand out of respect, but I'm not going to repeat the prayer.
What about a nonprofit organization who's hosting an event? Lots of different people attending. If a person wants to lead their own prayer service, right, and say, okay, those of us from this congregation are going to meet here at such and such time before the event and whatnot. How do we feel about that? Where there's lots of other people around, but you're not including them.
So I've always felt that when going down that road, if it's something that is a single person is trying to lead it off on the side, I always feel like it's such a slippery slope. Like I always do. I would prefer to always err on the side of caution when it comes to these things, because especially if it's, a nonprofit. So if I was running a nonprofit, for example, and, was relying on donations for survival, mm-hmm. and was trying to work to help feed the community or something like those in need, then I probably would prefer it not happen. And I think if someone came to me, I would say that if you wanted to do that outside the doors of where we're meeting, that's your decision. But I don't want to give the impression to anybody that we are excluding anyone. Right. So that's just how I would do it, because I always feel like it's such a slippery slope.
Yeah.
And could you do, I get the, and feel like the, in most cases, the intent of the person is good, that they want to be, and I respect them for that, but I'm always careful about, could this put off others and do more harm than good?
I like that you mention the person's intent, because I think a lot of these cases that make it to the courts, where prayer is held at the beginning of government meetings or schools or whatever, start with good intentions. I don't think any of them are trying to indoctrinate people. I think we truly believe that, we want to invite and invoke the Spirit of God into our midst in order to help guide us into what is the truth and what is best for us. And if you believe in a living interventionalist God, then of course you want to invoke that. Like if you believe that you have ready access to the creator of the universe, and that creator of the universe wants to lend a hand, then why wouldn't you ask for some help when determining handicap parking spaces at the community center? Like, of course, I get that. I get that 100%. And again, professional prayer here. I love it. My fear comes from the unintended consequences that we've seen throughout history. And a lot of what we talked about last week too, where when government picks up the trappings of religion, it gives them a certain authority and legitimacy that they didn't earn. They almost accidentally sometimes start to they get divine permission to do things and to back up their beliefs. And, you know, we've prayed before this meeting, and so therefore the outcome is ordained by God. And whether that's explicitly said or just implicitly implied, it's dangerous in that regard. It is dangerous to mix our sources of authority. And so for that reason, it gives me pause.
I actually feel much more comfortable with the idea of prayer in a nonprofit organization than what it seems like maybe the rest of y'all feel. But that's just because there are so many different kinds of nonprofits. I mean, technically, like, religious organizations are nonprofits. And so it depends what we're talking about specifically and where the specific funds and donations come from. With that being said, of course, there are situations where I would feel more uncomfortable if I was, at a university or something that I, even if it has technical, like, nonprofit status, if its goals are something more social than religious, something that has a more wide-reaching impact on society, or like secular society, maybe we could even phrase it that way, then I would feel more uncomfortable with a prayer than if I was walking into any religious institution and the expectation is that, of course, there's going to be prayer. So it's just a little bit tricky, I think, to draw that line when there are a lot of subcategories under nonprofit status that it's not as easy to say, like, yes or no. And yeah, I also have a question, but I don't want to ask it until we feel like we've resolved Rachel's questions, unless that's how everyone feels.
I feel resolved.
The question I have goes back to our conversation about prayer in governmental spaces. And I just am interested in the things that y'all have been saying about it. And so it would be interesting for me to hear us go around and say, if we had to choose the moment of silence route or the tradition route where you have people invited to pray from specific traditions, and we can, talk about like how that could be done in an equitable way that is fair to multiple religious traditions instead of only asking Christians to come pray in those spaces. But given that, we can just assume that there's no option where we can't remove prayer completely. Like, what would you choose if you had to choose between those two, and why?
Well, if you try to be ecumenical and you invite a Christian this week and a Jew next week and a Muslim the week after and whatnot, you have to at some point also invite a secular humanist and an atheist. And what are they going to do? I mean, we had recently a Pastafarian pastor led a prayer at an Alaska government meeting recently. Now, for those of you at home who aren't familiar with the Pastafarian religion, it's not real in as much as it was created as a social commentary and as to poke at the way that religions are given preference. It started in...
It's almost like... It's a religion in as much as The Onion is a newspaper.
It's a good way to put it. Spaghetti monster.
Right. They have the Flying Spaghetti Monster. It started in 2005, right, in response to the Kansas State Board of Education's hearings on evolution in school, which uh-huh. Ian has a lot to say about.
That's for another episode.
That's for another episode. That's going to be a whole episode.
Or two or three
but
or four.
But yeah. They wear a colander on their head, which they have won the privilege to be able to wear that in their driver's license pictures in certain states because it's a religious headgear. And if they're going to allow Sikhs to wear their turbans, then they have to allow Pastafarians to wear their colanders. And so this guy opened prayer and he said, "So I'm called to invoke the power of the true inebriated creator of the universe, the drunken tolerator of all lesser and more recent gods, and maintainer of gravity here on earth. May the great flying spaghetti monster rouse himself from his stupor and let his noodly appendages ground each assembly member in their seats." Which is intentionally ridiculous. And there was also an invocation from a member of the Satanic Temple, which doesn't actually worship Satan, like the Judeo-Christian Satan, which would be ridiculous. They do it for the same reason.
Nor do they believe in Satan.
Right. They don't. But they led people in saying, "Hail Satan," in their opening prayer, which caused some people to storm out and protest. So if we do allow an ecumenical group to open in prayer, then we have to open it up to everyone. And for some people, they will want to open in protest. There are plenty of people who are non-religious at all. So what do we do? What do we do for the secular humanist? Do we allow you to read a passage from Kurt Vonnegut at the beginning of the meeting or what? And so I'm more in favor of a moment of silence, just as a time of retrospection and inward focus, but I would want to get rid of the whole thing altogether.
I have to disagree, Zach. Shocking.
Wonderful.
This goes back to a conversation we've had in the last few weeks. At some point, we don't have to tolerate everything. We really don't. We don't have to tolerate sarcasm. We don't have to tolerate insulting. We don't have to tolerate, we don't have to. So if the intention, going back to this idea of intention, if the intention is to make fun of, if the intention is to parade at in a negative way, I don't think we have to invite people like that. I really don't. That is not the place for it. I don't disagree that the Pastafarians have a right to exist as a political and social commentary. I love reading their stuff. I love reading The Onion. But I'm not going to invite The Onion to participate in a reporter's banquet. Right? There's a difference in saying I am doing this as satire and I get to have a seat at the table. To me, there's a complete difference. Now, secular humanist? Sure. You want to read a poem by somebody? Absolutely. You want to take those moments and give them the honor that they're due in whatever
the
way.
Gravity.
Thank you. That's the word. That's gravity. Right?
Bless his noodly appendages.
Yes. Then wonderful. But if you're just going to make fun of people, that's not okay. Ever. Right, that's not okay to do in a public forum. So I don't think because that slippery slope gets to the point of saying, well, what about those organizations which are not satirical but are spewing hate? Right? If we give everyone a chance to speak, then at some point we're giving a platform to those that profess hate as the basis of their identity and the basis of their culture, if not their religion. And I don't excuse that. I don't allow for that. So that's my disagreement with you, Zach. And to answer specifically to Kendra, you gave us a very black and white question and made the assumption or assertion that we can't just get rid of it. I don't know why we can't just get rid of it.
I assumed that we all wanted to get rid of it.
Okay, got it. So if we want to get rid of it, great. But if if that is not the possibility, then I would leave it as a moment of reflection. And that's a very nuanced way of saying it, rather than a moment of silence, because silence, a lot of things happen in silence and people don't get the ability to find their own voices, but a moment of reflection. Because if going all the way back to Franklin and the idea that the purpose of this role is to change the mood, to change the attackingness of government people, of politicians, then we need to look inward, and we need to, if we're not doing prayer, then we need to at least look inward and say, okay, what truly is my purpose? And leave it at that. So I would be much more for a moment of reflection than what we currently have.
I don't know if I'm necessarily in favor of getting rid of everything. I don't like the idea of prayer. I could get on board with the idea of a moment of reflection, but the way I think about it, especially as a military brat, that during those moments of silence that we have, I use it to think about those who paid the ultimate sacrifice for all of us. And that's just from my, you know, I was never in the military, but I've, you know, growing up on a military base overseas, and then lots of family members who are in the military and friends in the military, that to me, it's, you know, no matter if I disagree with them or not, you know, I always make a special point of recognizing our members of military, our first responders, those who willingly put their lives on the line so that I can live in this country and have the freedoms that I have. And so I look at those, that moment of silence as a moment, or if we, you know, if it became a moment of reflection, whatever, but there would be a time to honor what they've done and to honor their families and to honor those who are still with us. Not just the ones who have paid that ultimate sacrifice and died, but just honor any person who has been willing to do that and serve in either the military or first responders, but that who protect us. So that's why I always look at those moments.
Well, so flip it around. And instead of thinking about forced prayer or forced religious sentiment in a public space, the forced bringing of the state into religious spaces and services drives me nuts way more than the other. And this is probably coming from my place as a religious leader, but, you know, and I'm sorry for all of my congregants that are listening, but I really have a problem with flags in the sanctuary. And it's not a hill I'm willing to die on. It's a personal peeve, and so I'm never going to make a big deal out of it in my church. But it bothers me on a fundamental level that we would bring in images of the state into a sanctuary. I believe a sanctuary is like it's like an embassy. That this ground I consider to be a part of the kingdom of God, away from the kingdom of America. So to bring that in and to raise up patriotism in this place bothers me. Like, I'm going to pray for my leaders, but I'm going to pray for them and hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be a prophet more than the court's religious leader. You know, I think about when King Herod erected an eagle over the temple in order mm-hmm. to appease the Romans who appointed him there. And it caused such a stir that a group of 40 young men climbed the temple and cut it down with axes when they thought that Herod was dying and couldn't do anything about it, and caused this whole riot and all of that, because you don't mix the two. You don't, you let God's space be God's space, and you let that be the corrector of government and not the affirmer of government. And so I would be much happier if we just kept our own space. And instead of, you know, a pastor leading the prayer at the beginning of a trial, have the pastor be outside the doors to comfort those who were a part of this and to pray with them and to pray against corrupt systems.
Yeah, have it. I and that's what I was saying earlier when we talk about like the idea of nonprofits, for example, that are not religiously based nonprofits, that, you know, have it available. Have people there who, if they want to pray, have that space where they can do that, but make it clear that although I may personally agree with the prayer, I am not saying that the entire organization does that, so that we are inclusive for everyone and that everyone feels comfortable.
So Kendra, we've answered the question. So I'm going to toss the ball back to you and say, of these scenarios that you posted, which would you prefer?
Yeah, I probably don't have as strong a reaction as Zach does to seeing a flag in a church. But so I guess I would feel hypocritical saying that I oppose seeing flags in churches, because there are some churches I walk into, see an American flag and roll my eyes. And then there are other churches that I walk into and I'm more down with the causes that they are trying to affect in the world. So it feels more difficult for me personally to work out my own beliefs about it, because, for example, I attend a church now that is very political, and they're not a church that has flags hanging in any of the internal spaces that I have been aware of. So it's not that there's like internal symbols of patriotism, but the things that we do as a congregation are political. So it's just hard for me to sort out where that line is, because I think that part of what it means in like liberal Christian churches to be Christian is to be political in a sense, and to be political in ways that affect social change, that will help the marginalized and create a better world for people. And so I don't know. It's kind of a tricky question. But because at the same time, I don't want to hear someone from the pulpit like preaching a sermon about, you know, like who we should vote for.
Right.
Well, that is actually technically
illegal. I don't want that.
I'm sure it happens
just
now.
Just so you know.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Pessimist.
It doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Right, it doesn't necessarily mean anything. I mean, there's a difference between, as someone who does speak from the pulpit a lot, there's a difference between being political and being partisan, especially now where we're saying, well, what's political? And it feels like everything is political. Mm-hmm. Regardless of what topic it is, you know, oh, let's help the homeless. That's political. What? Why is that political? Right? Let's help the vulnerable. What? So everything is political, but we're not, the difference is partisan, right? Saying this is the way you should believe and vote.
Politics is just our life together. So
right.
Everything it's that we do that affects life. Our life together is going to be intrinsically political. When I preach about mm-hmm. climate change from the pulpit, I'm preaching theologically about care for our planet and the most vulnerable and our lives together. And that will just, by its very nature, end up being political, and it will turn some people off, and they will hear me being partisan, even if I'm not, because the lines when it comes to climate change have been drawn so starkly between Democrats mm-hmm. and Republicans that it's almost a death sentence if you're a Republican to believe in climate change and think that we need to do something about it. So they've made it partisan, and it's not, but they've made it that way. And so when I talk about it, I have to be so careful not to step over that line. That drives me nuts.
Yeah, I agree.
And I agree too. And I guess that's really just the problem is that I think when we agree, it's easier to call it political. And when we disagree, it's easier to label something as partisan. And like it's not that I don't have strong beliefs about what is right politically. And there are things that I could easily be called partisan for when I would say I was just like speaking what I think is politically true. But it's just messy on the ground. Even though I agree with what you're all saying, I don't think that's how it unfolds when you're standing in front of someone who is not seeing eye to eye with you.
Agreed. It's messy. Yep. All around.
Yeah. I also have to go.
Well, we will continue next week with you, Kendra, and we'll continue this conversation for a little bit longer. I wanted to respond to the flag in the sanctuary piece.
I saw your face when I said that.
I know. I don't have a poker face. I'm okay with that since I don't play poker.
You have a podcast face. Nobody can see it. So.
It's true. But you can still call me out. So what I reacted to, and that's what it was a reaction when you were saying that you don't want to see flags in a sanctuary for some sort of allegiance and, you know, the authority, which we've had conversations about that in previous episodes. I think that comes from a place of privilege. So I say that gently, and because when there's a religion in the minority, especially a religion in the minority, which is not necessarily quote unquote native to the country that they're in, there is this feeling that their allegiance is elsewhere and it is ripe for attack. And it's another way that the minority can say, no, there's a difference that we are actually separating, that there are two different allegiances that we have from a civil standpoint, an allegiance to the country in which we live. And from a religious standpoint, we have an allegiance to whatever our religion and culture tells us. But for very, very many Jewish congregations, there have been this conversation over and over again for hundreds of years, right? Do we have an American flag in the sanctuary? And then in the last 70 years, do we put an Israeli flag in the sanctuary? Right? And if we do put them in the sanctuary, you know, first of all, are they in the building? Second of all, are they in the sanctuary? And if they are in the sanctuary, do they go on the Bima, on the platform from which we speak, from where the Torah is? Right? And each congregation comes to their own conclusion. But generally speaking, many synagogues that aren't in Israel post the colors of the country they're in to tell the majority that, yes, they are still within allegiance of their country and that there's no reason to fight against us in those ways. So that would have to be my pushback, that it is coming from a place of majority.
It is. And my aversion to this comes from my time with the Mennonites, who took Jesus' words extremely literally during the Reformation. And they said, you can't swear oaths. My kingdom is not of this world. So they wouldn't swear oaths and they wouldn't run for office. They wouldn't serve in the military. They wanted to be a separate thing as Jesus did as well. And for that, they got killed by Catholics and Protestants alike. They were the one group within the church that it seemed like everyone was okay with persecuting. But I think they had a point. I mean, that's the reason why the Amish are so separate, because it was a safety concern. They wanted to be away from the oppressive majority so they could have this almost separate kingdom of God on earth. So I get that. I do. And I acknowledge that if I were to remove the American flag from my sanctuary, it would just be, you know, that uppity pastor. It wouldn't be cause for sedition and, you know, their allegiance lies elsewhere. And I get that today, that it is safer for me to play these games than it was for the Mennonites in the 1500s or the Jews today. I still think that if I'm going to be faithful to Jesus, to the life, the teachings, the example of Jesus, then I have to affirm those truths that he said, that my kingdom is not of this world. All power of political authority is given to them and can be taken, and that this whole order of things needs to be shaken up and overturned. I mean, Jesus wasn't killed for being a really nice guy and a good moral teacher. He was killed because he was an enemy of the state and he threatened their power. And the church got in bed with power and we liked it. And we've been fighting back ever since, because in being the majority and being the power, we're denying our very DNA and our very founder's heart and soul. We had to sell out in order to be the majority in power. And this is why I'm super excited for the death of Christendom. And I know I get a lot of flack from my people when I say that it doesn't bother me when churches close, and that I think it's a wonderful thing that there's not a big church on every corner, and that it's not just assumed you're going to be a Christian anymore and Christians are not respected anymore. I think that's great. I think that's wonderful. I think we have spent too long in power. You know, 1700 years is more than enough time to be in power. And we have lost our soul so many times along the way. And once we are not in that respected position of power and privilege, I think we will, as a church, rediscover the powerful words of Jesus, and we will serve once again as the people who hold government accountable and not the people who give government approval.
That's really speaking very prophetically, right? In the sense of speaking truth to power is what I mean by that statement. Rather than letting power speak the truth.
Yeah. Well, and I also acknowledge that most prophets didn't stay on the payroll or even among the living for very long. So I hope that
we want you to be on the living for a very long time.
And I hope to still be, you know, still have my
That's
job.
My second hope. My first hope is you stay living.
Less about the payroll and more about the community, that I hope to be able to lead my community in rediscovering the power and not just being respectable Christians who are comfortable in power. This has been episode 12 of the Down the Wormhole podcast. If you like what you hear, tell your friends. The more the merrier. Rachel's taken over writing the show notes, so they are unbelievably extensive and amazing. Check it all out at downthewormhole.com. Next week, we are returning to Mauna Kea and having an amazing conversation with a native Hawaiian pastor about the intersection of Western science and indigenous spirituality. You are not going to want to miss this one. And I know it's been kind of a tradition to end these episodes with a clip from the episode taken completely out of context, but I was thinking maybe that this time...
Tradition!
Well, alrighty then.